welcome back to the One Link Podcast. I am Brad, and I'm joined, as always, by James. How's it going, James?
It is going fabulous this morning. How about yourself?
Good, good. I'm doing well. I'm pretty excited about our guests today, all the way from across the pond. You want to introduce our guests today?
Yeah, so today we're continuing our series on working with the unreligious, and today we have Martha Moore on with us. Martha, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
So tell us a little bit about your story. How did you get to where you are today, which is the Netherlands, yes?
Yes, I'm in Amsterdam, the capital of the Netherlands in Europe. I'm from Tampa, Florida, originally. So Tampa and Florida are kind of mixed faith anyway. So that kind of gave me a little bit of a leg up. I was surrounded by a lot of Spanish speakers. So I learned Spanish. I was very fascinated. I thought I'd end up in South America at one point. I had a very wise mom and dad who loved missions. And my dad had been trained on staff with NAVS and with CREW. So we heard a lot of stuff about discipleship and evangelism, and we did it at our church. And my dad was doing discipleship, my mom too, with people. So that was a natural part of what I learned growing up as church life. But I heard about my dad and his campus ministry days.
Mm-hmm. And did you like always feel a call to missions or to cross-cultural work, or when did that?
You know, we had so many missionaries at the church over the years. I kept thinking, so the answer is yes. I kept thinking, oh, you know, some of them are a little odd, but some are kind of normal and some do, but they do all kinds of jobs. I mean, I could do that too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So which category would you put yourself in now, Martha? The normal or the odd?
The odd. Yeah.
No, we'd never say that about you.
No, I never pictured myself doing, like, you know, I said, I'm not like the CEO type, but I'm like, I'm going to pray into whatever God's vision is.
So you grew up learning about all this. When did you first go overseas?
Yeah, we did like a youth trip to Mexico. I went to Baylor and got my secondary education degree, and they had a vision mission trip to Canada, to Alberta over spring break. I did a couple other mission trips like Belize, but then I went with my father also. I went to seminary, and during seminary, I did a summer in Venezuela, and that not with my father. And then I did a couple trips with him to three countries in Africa. And all the time I was, and to Brazil, and all the time I was thinking, because I really felt like God had led me to missions, would this be the part of the world I would fit in? So it was on my radar for a long time.
Cool. So how did you finally get overseas? And where did you finally hear God be like, and this is it, you're home?
Yeah. I applied two places. I applied at OU. So the classic BCM. Damn. At OU with Max, and because they asked me, come up and, you know, we'd like to meet you. And then I heard about a guy named Dave Bartow up in Vancouver, Canada. And so I took, long story short, took a prayer and fasting day. And you know how you can compare pros and cons? I compared pros and pros because it was like they were totally different. But campus ministry startup internationally, campus ministry where you learn a lot and you know, you're in a great setting. And long story short, God led me to Vancouver, very postmodern, you know, and where you don't have a building. And it was such a great, that was my first mission point. Yeah, was serving after seminary in Vancouver.
Okay. How long were you there?
I was there 4 years. And then after that, got asked to be on staff with Neil and Melinda Walker at USC in California. So I was there 2 years. So I was on the West Coast for quite a while, learning from different ministries, but still very much startup stages, which God had really implanted in me the desire to start things from scratch.
This is a bit off script, Martha, but you just kind of piqued my curiosity. In the circles that we run in, you know, there's this tension I feel of being more apostolic, kind of going where there are fewer ministries or fewer churches or fewer believers, and kind of a, well, you need more support. You need to be hearing, be mentored more, you know, kind of that side of things. How did you know, why didn't you say, hey, at OU, maybe I'd have more support, I'd have more of a mentor, more established? What was in you that wanted to go to these harder places?
Okay, well, here's the backstory. what God had been laying on my heart the few years in college and seminary, based on my gifting and based on I want to go internationally one day long term, I was like, where would be the best training for that with some supervision? But you're already international. You're in Canada, but you don't have to learn a new language. And so, you know, you still have that. You can kind of pop across the border easily. So there were a lot of pluses that I was like, this lines up exactly with where I think I'm going to go. I'd been at Hope Church. They were always sending people out from Fort Worth that were starting new churches. So I was like, I'd be a part of a church plant. I'd be a part of a new campus ministry. It just aligned. On the other hand, actually, Max uninvited me. So that's the other story. Everyone said, be mentored, go where you want it to look like one day, and then you'll know how to build it later. And so I finally reluctantly said, oh, I should probably go to Norman, Oklahoma for training. Okay, I will do that. And God closed the door. He said, actually, now we're a full staff. And they'd already had me up there twice. So then it was sort of, people were like, oh, Martha, how are you doing? I said, I'm ecstatic. I get to go to Vancouver.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes a closed door is an open one. It makes some easier decision making.
Exactly. Good question.
So fast forward a little bit, you were in Canada, that other foreign country called California. Yeah. And then how did you get over to Europe?
Yeah, there were a few years in between helping my dad in ministry, just doing really a servant role, secretarial role, editing books, and some stuff happened in my family's life, some health issues and things. I had a brother in his 20s who passed away. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like God wanted to bring some more personal closure for me before going overseas. And I also was single and I was like, I don't want to do a Christian sorority. Like I really want to have a ministry with, you know, men and women on the college campus being reached. So it seemed like God delayed that trip over for me based on a couple of things he wanted to do to prep me for that. But I applied with the IMB. A request finally came through for Germany. And I thought, oh, okay. Cause I started seeing stuff on TV. Everything was like Germany, Germany, Germany. I was praying for Northern Europe. I prayed for Spain, but I was like, no, I don't think it's the Southern area. I think it's going to be Northern Europe. I think that's going to be more like the West Coast. And I got invited to go to Jena. It looks like Jena, J-E-N-A, Jena, Germany in the East. Fast forward. I was there for about 13 years. In between, moved to Spain for 2 years. And then was invited to come back in Germany, and then was invited to come to Amsterdam.
And that was all that time was working with college students in a college ministry setting?
Exactly. All with university students. And after 2 years in Jena, we finally put a name on it. So it would be more like, okay, what is this thing? You know, is this the Monday group? Well, it's more than Monday. Is it Martha's group? I'm like, oh my, it's not my group. It's Jesus' group. So, but I wanted everything to be reproducible. So I didn't want to just artificially stick names on things. I wanted to make sure that I had a lot of ideas from my experience on the West Coast and, you know, other mentors, but make sure that it fit culturally. So after 2 years, we called it Connection, with two little X's that are like two little people. Yeah. So the logo.
I just now realized that's what it was. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Two people connecting, but they're off center. So one of them's a little higher. So if you look at it skewed, there's the cross. So the vertical relationship with God through Jesus and the horizontal relationship that has changed because I'm connected to Christ.
There you go. That's cool. So what, and one more context clue for myself. So Jena, that would have been in former East Germany, mm-hmm, then, mm-hmm. Under Soviet control for however year, how many years,
right,
until?
So I came in and people were like, good luck. Like everyone here is atheist. So I loved the challenge, but because it was very, I mean, you can use terms, but just for the sake of it, postmodern, people don't know what they don't know. So, but they knew they didn't know. So they knew, yeah, I don't know anything about Christianity. I loved it. It was amazing. Yeah. I loved it. Yeah. There was some Protestantism in that area, but not really Catholic. So Germany, like some countries in Europe, things are very much divided regionally by the heritage religiously of that area. Yeah. But they'd had 40 years of communism. So
that's maybe a good segue, James. as we told you before the before we started here, we're working on a series for people working with unreligious groups. You mentioned atheists, or some people are just sort of agnostic. What was there, you know, it's easy for us to think, well, we've got a lot of that in America. So you were already ready when you went to Europe, you know, kind of same Western postmodern mentality, but I'm guessing that's probably not accurate. What were some of the unique differences you saw?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, definitely being in California and being in Canada, that was great preparation for me. Of course, I've been gone a long time, so I'm not as accurate in comparing the US scene. But one of the differences is I feel it's not a political thing. It's not aligned with, you know, what politics stand do you have. In Europe, I would say what I tell teams that come atheist or people without faith don't seem to be angry. It's more like it's irrelevant and I don't care. But I've had people do spiritual surveys with them. And they say, you know, good luck. I don't think I'm your target group. So, you know, I don't really think I could help you today, but you know, good luck. Have a nice one. So, you know, it's like, it's not mean. It's not like, get out of my face. It's like, hey, it's irrelevant. The Dutch also have a word that's, it's like its own religion. It's called in Dutch, eatsism. The word eats, I-E-T-S, means something. And I think we find that in the US too. It's like, you know, I think there's something out there. Mm-hmm. You know, I believe in this, you know, thing in the higher power or whatever. Well, they give a name to it. You can Wikipedia it, eatsism. It's, I believe in somethingism. So I've had students even tell me, oh, I don't know if you've heard. Basically, they're saying that's my religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very interesting. So you would say basically there doesn't seem to be any chip on their shoulder or less chip on their shoulder.
Right.
But they just kind of like, we've seen that in our history and we don't care anymore. It doesn't fit.
Right. Indifferent. So how, it can be scarier. Because they're like, I don't think you're relevant. So I'm not interested in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. So how did you begin? How do you begin? I don't want to keep it always back in Jena. So you can weave that story as it's changed or maybe what it is today. How do you engage with a little bit of how did you engage when you were younger too, as our students will be when they go?
Yeah. Well, you know, the best way anywhere is building a relationship. So whatever way I can find to piggyback on another student, I'm not a student. I mean, I've taken a couple classes, but anyway, I can get to be friends with your friend. So we call that concept connecting the ponds. So in Matthew, Jesus said, follow me and I will make you become fishers of men. So I say, what's harder, following or fishing? You know, I get different answers, but Jesus, the burden is off me that Jesus says, I will make you to become fishers of men. Obviously, we do training in that. So to connect the ponds means who are the fish in your pond that you're fishing for? And if you go, well, I don't know any not yet Christians, we call them NYCs, like New York City, not yet Christians, okay. With the hope that, you know, God is wanting.
Yes.
The fact that I know them is God already saying, I want to reveal my son to you. And so you have NYCs, I have NYCs. So that's the little fish. So we draw a pond, we put little fish in there and we name them. We say, let's pray for each other's fish. Now let's find a way to connect them. But it may not be an official ministry event. It could just be whatever they're into, whether it's playing soccer, we call it football here, whether it's baking muffins, whether it's going to a Japanese garden, the cherry blossom festival. You know, in Spain, we did English clubs. So that was from our ministry, but it was something that made sense to people. And then we met them at English club. And then we would get to know them, go salsa dancing, have fun, and ask them if they would like to do the next step, which would be reading the Bible with us.
And what was their response? What percentage said yes to that, would you say?
Oh, wow, that's hard. You mean that would like come to something fun and then actually get
yes
toward the word?
Take the next step. We're willing to investigate, I guess.
Wow. Maybe a fourth, a okay. fourth, a mm-hmm. third. The statistic is higher if there's repeat. So, you know, if there's repeated, they come around the group, the next picnic, the next party, then the chance is going to be high. They're going to go, well, I mean, Jesus is off the wall and stupid, but you're not stupid. So maybe, you know, maybe I'll check it out. At least check it out. Yeah. Uh-huh. That's a great question.
That's and funny.
We share the gospel earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, we out ourselves early.
And by that, you mean you're coming from the beginning, like, hey, we're a Christian organization, or I'm a Christian. You're bringing up faith.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Flying your flag.
Yeah. An easy thing is for me, because I'm international, to say, you know, I've heard, you know, tell me what it's like for you in Amsterdam, or tell me what most students think about spiritual things, or we do spiritual surveys on campus. So that's an artificial way to get with them and hear their story.
So tell me, so you make friends, you engage with them. How to say it? I think there's also a stereotype I have in my mind of German specifically. I don't know much about the Dutch. Maybe I do.
Like the apologetic debating side, or
yeah, more the cold side. Like they're cold, okay. They're efficient. You know, like, do they want to make friends with you? How open are they to new friends? Are their inner walls higher or their outer walls? Yeah, exactly. Seen too many movies. You know, just stereotypes. And I feel like that's a lot of what we talk about on this podcast, is things that we perceive to be true but actually aren't.
That's a great question. The Germans are extremely loyal. There, you can build great friendships, lifetime friendships with Germans. I mean, I go to weddings from people I haven't seen in a few years, you know, back in Germany, now that I'm in the Netherlands. So there's not the American style of frivolity. Like, for instance, we don't have university teams. We have clubs that can play sports, but you might be playing with other people in the city, maybe with all students, but we don't have the kind of the rah-rah mentality of America. So at university, it is about learning, you know, but when they're not at university, there's all kinds of things. People are into art and music and, you know, the football club that they're playing with, and a student association, a ski club, you know, hanging out with their friends. In Dutch, we call it a borrel, B-O-R-R-E-L. That's kind of like in Spain, you have tapas, go out and get something to drink and have little snacks. So there's high relational. In Europe, a lot of Europe, they're not going to give you the bill. Like, you know, in America, you go 30 minutes in, they're saying, I'll just set this right here, you know, no rush. And I'm thinking, no, I do feel rushed. Here, you own the table. So let me tell you, that's the conversations you're having, that people, if they make an appointment with you, you know, I had a student one time, he's like, don't give me less than 2 hours. You know, he's not doing this, give me a little 20-minute conversation. Or I try to get conversations with people, they're like, oh, I don't have time. I'm like, of course you have time. But they're thinking, no, but we need to sit down and have a real coffee. So I love that. So then you can get in real conversations with students, and but there's not the frivolity side. And they would say Americans, a lot of Germans would say Americans are superficial. Hi, how are you? Fine. And you're like, what? Was that a real question answer? Yeah. The Dutch are more frivolous. They are more like fun, laughter. I always thought it would be fun to work in Holland, and then God tapped me on the shoulder, come on over to the Netherlands. But it's a very small country. So in juxtaposition, they're used to so many expats coming and going. They may not want to be best friends with you, because they're like, I know you guys come and go all the time. I want the friends that are going to be with me for a lifetime.
So when you have these conversations, these 2-hour coffees, is this, that sounds good. Sign me up. Is this one of those cultures, or do you find it to be where you like, you have to talk about less important things for 30 minutes or an hour before you can get into the more? Or are they ready to kind of dive into the deeper conversations to begin with?
I think that's a fair question. I think for students that would come over, they would expect a lot more favorite music and, you know, tell me about this and which movie did you see last weekend? They're going to expect that more. With me, because it's my job, they're not surprised that I'm going to go for gospel quicker, or just more deeper conversation quicker. Not that they really are for students either, but just because by the nature of it, when I get an appointment, I mean, they know what I do for a living, you know, or if it's a follow-up to a survey, they're like, yeah, I just did a spiritual survey with you. I know what we're going to talk about.
We're going to talk about it.
But yeah, I'm definitely going to lean into, tell me about your family. You know, even sometimes when people artificially or too quickly ask spiritual questions, I'll go, whoa, but wait, I just wanted to, wait, tell me about your studies, tell me about your family. What are your plans for the summer? You know, I want to make sure that we really are friends and it isn't just a kind of a contractual interview and then we're done.
We're beginning a relationship. Mm-hmm. And for students, how do you feel like when we are like send a team over, what's the best way to get involved, to get into one of those conversations? So I feel like that's what we're all scared of in America, is the getting into the conversation. Being in the conversation, we're not as scared of, but because of maybe the perception of the angry atheist or the angry postmodern, whatever, we're kind of scared to ask. How would you advise?
Yeah, good question. There's definitely posters on campus about different events that are happening. So maybe not a club that you would had to have joined before, you know, a couple months before, but there'll be certain events or movie nights that you could go, oh, let's do that. And definitely surveys. We have a 5-question survey that's long enough that you can start to get to know the person, but short enough that you can keep moving on. So we say we're looking for low-hanging fruit. So I could have an hour-long conversation, but right now I'm just trying to get through a larger number of people. But one of the questions is, it's very existential, I would say, can you tell me about an experience you've ever had where you felt like there was something bigger than yourself, or maybe that wasn't a coincidence? I'd be really curious to hear that. So I'm wanting to hear people's stories and lean into that before I'm ready to tell my story. But it can be I've had a 15-minute conversation and I say, so we're pretty much done, but I don't know, do you have a question for us? And they'll say, well, yeah, why do you do this? And I say, the answer is always Jesus. Get in a 30-second, 1-minute testimony about how you came to Christ. Yeah. We do solarium. We do the solarium survey as a follow-up after that as well. So some of this is kind of that artificial meet the person and then start following up and getting ice cream where it's the more natural thing.
Gotcha. Once you start these conversations, what do you feel like are some of the bigger barriers to belief? I want to layer a couple of questions on here. What are some of the barriers to belief when you get into it? Kind of like this existential question. Do you find that they're actually unreligious? Or is unreligious like kind of like where I was at? A lot of people said they were atheists, but they actually, you know, still burn money to their ancestors and they, you know, they did all kinds of religious things. They just like cloaked it. Like, are they really religious? And then what are some of their barriers?
I would say in general, again, we're, you know, there's people from a Christian faith background in the Netherlands or Germany, but generally, no, maybe Christmas worship service, you know, Christmas Eve, maybe once a year. But pretty much if they're non-religious, it is not fit into their calendar in any way. Although every once in a while I'll meet somebody, they'll say, I started reading the Bible, and I'm like, ding, ding, ding.
Yeah. How did they get, because, you know, you have some great theologians, churches, stuff. How did they become unreligious? Before we go into barriers, how did they become that way?
Okay. Well, great question. I'm not a great historian, to be honest, but definitely around the time of the 2 world wars, there was just a lot of exhaustion and, you know, just upheaval, societal upheaval. And my understanding is a lot of the seminaries were liberal, the kind of way that they were taking apart the Bible and trying to reduce it to no miracles and things like that. You know, this person didn't write this book. Isaiah didn't write Isaiah. And so there was a kind of an analytical way of trying to, I don't know, take apart the Bible in the seminaries. And so that's who went into the churches. And then we also had some churches that are more interested in kind of the articles of faith. I was at a church where I went with 2 students. This is a church, very conservative, like all the women wear dresses and the women wear a hat. The only thing is I never got the memo about the hat and I felt a little bit uncovered. So very conservative, I'm told. Okay, I'm in the Bible Belt in the Netherlands. The service barely had scripture. It was reading pages of articles of faith. So now that we've made our creed and these detailed versions of what we believe about Jesus being the Son of God, and we start getting away from the Bible, or we say it's about how you dress or outward symbols. And, or we say, well, if you're christened as a baby, you know, in the Protestant or the Catholic tradition in Germany or here, your membership in the church happens now. You're an infant and you got christened. You were a member. And you are a Christian now. And so there might be an affirming of that later, a process called confirmation or something else, but people's minds are messed with. And then they go, well, I did that course, or I did that sprinkling that my parents did. I'm good now. There's not anything practical. So they're like, why do I need to pay the tax? Because there's a church tax in Germany. So you're like, you know, I'd rather just kind of figure out things on my own without a tax for a place that I only go to once a year. So those are some of the factors, I think, that led to the whole population becoming unreligious.
Okay. So now let's go to the barrier question. What are some of their barriers? You start having these conversations, you're telling them about your story, maybe you're reading the Bible with them.
Great question. I would, first of all, James, I would say it's what I call cotton candy. You know, when you go to a park, a theme park or something, and they give you cotton candy and every kid wants it because it's pretty and it's fluffy and big and you taste it and it's sweet. And immediately it gets on your tongue. It's like, oh, it's gone. I need a little bit more. Oh, it's gone. And you pull it off. Oh, it's gone. And you're like, well, it's really sweet. It didn't last for long. So they have a lot of satisfaction in cotton candy, I would say, in Europe. It is, I say Europe, that's, you know, general, but definitely Western Europe. There's a lot of wealth. There's a lot of opportunity. If you're in university, it already means you're, you know, the road is going well for you in the future. Money and travel. We are so close. So people go, oh, I took my mom's cabriolet and I drove down to Italy on the long weekend. You're like, oh, well, another student recently said, I'm going to Egypt for a friend's birthday. We're in the Netherlands. She's not even from the Netherlands. I'm like, wow. So I write her, I go, how was Egypt? She goes, didn't come about. I actually went over to Luxembourg. I mean, options, crazy options. I'm in a city with 100,000 university students, but they don't all live in the city because this is a barrier to belief. You're not around believers. They commute an hour or 2 hours. So even if you're like, let's hang out more, let's hang out in the evenings or weekends, they're like, I only come in for university. I live with my folks because Amsterdam is so stinking expensive. You know, pride is a barrier to belief. Huge, huge, huge pride. I would say that for several countries, different ways it manifests itself. Lust is a big barrier because, you know, anything related to that, Jesus is for one man, one woman getting married for the rest of their life and commitment. And our culture doesn't, you know, encourage that. And lastly, I would say there's a lack of workers / they just don't know any Christians. I mean, literally, I'll ask people, do you know any other person that you've had a conversation like this one? No. Mm. So how will they know, you know, how will they hear unless somebody preaches, right?
Yeah. And I'm assuming there are some churches that are actual good churches, but are they just so few and far between?
They are few and far between. Yeah. Yeah. And then there's still some church membership at the tradition, you know, whatever that country would be, the traditional churches that people think, I'm good. I got it. I've got that membership thing if I want to go there. But yeah, good Bible believing churches that are also relevant and modern, very, even in Amsterdam, really hard to find. Yeah, I wanted to go to a Dutch church. I pursued a Dutch church. I came to be a part of a church planting team here. We weren't able to get things off the ground for several reasons. So then I said, okay, I'll go to an English speaking church. And a lot of Dutch people go there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there is a lack of churches, definitely.
What about when somebody does come to faith, especially coming from this what we've just said, lack of healthy churches? What are some of the distinctives of discipling them into a healthy, missional, outward-focused member of the body of Christ?
That's a great question. Well, the joy, James, is, and Brad, when they've come to faith in our ministry, all they know is that's how we do it. So they think it's
normal. They just do it the same way.
They think it's normal that you go to church on Sunday, that you share Christ with your friends, you invite them around picnics because, you know, you got invited around picnics, having a quiet time. So they think that's normal. They know how to talk about faith in a way that's not judgy. They understand you don't use a lot of jargon, you know, they don't assume people are Christians because they're like, well, of course they're not Christians because, I mean, I wasn't. So there's a lot of discipleship. We call it, you probably heard this, D-I-C-E, discipleship in the context of evangelism, D-I-C-E, discipleship in the context of evangelism. So while they're being quote unquote evangelized, that border of, you know, let's take the timeline, you know, first you're on the Ingalls scale, you're -5, you're -4, you're -3. There's stuff happening in that they're already starting to pray and they're like, they're not a believer yet. They're already starting to read the Bible. And I'm like, and then I keep asking, I just did this on Sunday with a guy. I go, okay, but you're reading the Bible. Are you praying? Yes, I'm praying. You go, do you think there was a point that you told me about this church in Brazil that you were at? Do you think maybe then you actually committed your life to Christ? He's like, I don't know. So it gets a little fuzzy of when did that transition happen? Sometimes they don't even know. I've had people in Spain say, somebody ask them, is everyone in our small group a believer? And people are like, yeah, I am. Because they want to know, am I the only one sitting in our small group discussion that's not a believer? You know, yo soy cristiano, I am Christian, I'm a Christian, yo soy cristiano. And so one of my friends had been around for over a year, I guess, maybe a year. He said, yeah, yo soy cristiano. And he said, I'm a Christian. I said, what? You're a Christian? Well, he backs up. I'm on the path. Estoy en el camino. I'm on the path. I'm like, wait, you just said you're a Christian. So this idea of being on this journey, I'm on the path, that it's not like a hard and fast. Sometimes they don't know when was that moment. That's a part of the discipleship. But like I said, that's already happening. They've already been hopefully inviting their friends around. So evangelism training, getting in the word. We have a small group. We call it small group right now, Bible discussion groups for believers and NYCs, not yet Christians. So in that, they're getting in the word if they would weekly with us. And no, we have certain like guidelines, no answers, like a stupid answer. So we don't correct people. And you go, oh my gosh, they said Jesus was just a charismatic cult leader. Why didn't you like stop that? I'm like, because I hope they'll come back. I don't have to, I'm not here as your teacher to correct you. Again, you're on the journey. I'm accompanying you on the journey. I do believe in truth, but I don't want to make you feel like you can't, you know, wrong answer. Yeah. That's a part of the discipleship mm-hmm. that's already happening.
Yeah. Let me push into that a little bit, because I think for some of our listeners, that's like what are you talking about? So the question is when do you push into that? Or how does that guy that starts with like Jesus was a charismatic cult leader, eventually he becomes a Christian. Does he still think, you know, like how does that transformation happen?
Oh, absolutely. The transformation happens in one-on-one conversations where you don't shame people. We definitely have a shame culture. People think, oh, some Asian cultures, we definitely have shame culture. So I'm not going to shame somebody in the group. I'm not going to make somebody look stupid in the group. And the groups are open. So, and we also have to train believers. You know, there's so much to dig into this one passage. It's not discipleship group. You go cross-reference this. I heard this sermon on Sunday. I listened to a podcast. This reminds me of what I read in my quiet time. Don't do that in the open small groups. Then they're like, oh, it's just for babies and baby Christians or non-Christians. Like, I don't want to come. I'm not going to learn. I'm like, are you kidding me? I learn from atheists. They pull out insights that somehow the Holy Spirit gives them where they go, well, do you think the disciples meant this? And I'm like, oh, and I prepared the questions. I'm like, never occurred to me. You know, so again, I'm relating to people as friends. I am on the same ground as you. I know Jesus, but Jesus died for them just like for me. So I'm going to let us be on that journey together. I'm just, you know, on a different stage.
Yeah. And you'll correct it at a different point in time, or just Christ himself will correct it
or one-on-one. Yeah, we'll do it one-on-one. You know, 5 people that have been on our staff in the past year, their families are not believers. So I've seen people go from I'm raised in atheism to I'm a full-on follower, disciple maker. So I've seen that happen. I know it can happen.
Is there a timeline that you would say that typically happens in?
Ooh, for somebody to get around our group and come to faith, it would be good if it took a year. Like if but that would mean they really came around and leaned in, maybe 6 months, you know, maybe 2 years. Yeah. Cause I mean, from that kind of background, you know, it can be hard. It's happened in 6 months for sure. To get to really be like disciple makers and then on staff, you're looking at a few years for that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was thinking just to the point of true conversion. I think it's important for our teams to know, like you may hit the guy when he's been there, he's on his 364th day and he's ready to jump in,
yes.
You know, but you may be on day one. And if you've moved him from day one to 30 days of exposure to Christ and thinking about Christ, man, that's a 12th of the way or whatever that number is.
Yes. So redefine success.
Yeah, that's a success. What about, tell me a little bit about this as your team has grown.
But I tell you one more illustration that I think is really helpful for the soil, because we talk about the four kinds of soil from scripture. David Acton, who was one of my supervisors in Seville, Spain, said, you know, before you can reap, you have to sow. Before you sow, you're going to get seeds in the ground. You're going to have to plow up the ground and water it. You're going to have to pull up rocks. So even to go past the point, I'm sowing the seed of the scripture and the gospel. I'm like, you know, you may be sowing and the ground has got rocks. It's got weeds in it that still have to be pulled up. And so what the other thing that happens is we say, God, would you, you know, kind of in a metaphorical, would you rain down, you know, just fresh rain of your Holy Spirit and soften the ground with rain. And what he said is when you come, you may just be water droplets. What happens if you put rain on dry ground? You have floods, you have washout. It cannot absorb it. So you're trying to put seeds. The ground isn't even ready for the seeds maybe. So you may just be the water droplets softening the ground. And I thought, wow, you're taking it all the way back. So success is for you maybe just being water droplets of little gospel conversations and teaching them Christians can be cool and friendly and whatever that is. Yeah. So you had a question, James. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask, I know on your staff now, you have people from a variety of countries. I think we're going to have Alex on here talking some just about his testimony of how he came to faith. What's it been like having some of these people join your staff, having a multi-ethnic staff? How's that affected your ability to reach the unreached? How's that changed your ministry?
Totally changed my ministry, you know, because, you know, they say the resources are in the harvest. And so I tried to believe that and go, okay, God, the harvest field, I want the resources of money, not just to come from the States, workers to come from the land that I'm tilling. So would you raise up laborers from Germans? Would you raise up interns from Dutch, from Spain? And so far he's done that in all three countries. It is harder. You know, it is harder when they come from no background. It definitely enriches our team. I mean, the way people are wired, you know, just people, of course, have spiritual gifts and talents, but there's certain things about Germans being, Alex is an engineer, things totally different than me, you know? And so the way that they're thinking, and of course, that's important that I learn the language of each place that I live so I can get the nuances, you know, they can tell me in their own language, or the Bible discussion group can be English or German or Dutch. Yeah, I love having multinational teams. And I love the fact that, yeah, they're just going to bring different gifting. They're going to have different way to relate to the students because they're like, oh yeah, I remember that with my professor. And I'm like, I didn't get a degree in this country. They get it a different way than I do.
I'm going to ask one more question. I think we're probably getting to that point, but I'm curious, people that work with Muslims, you maybe hear them talk about trends of, well, this person came to faith because they had a dream or a vision, or maybe with Hindus, certain areas, it's a miraculous thing happened. Are there trends you're seeing in Europe of people coming to faith for maybe they had a personal crisis or is every situation kind of unique to itself?
I don't know if I see a trend. I do see some interesting things that happen over the years. If people have gone to the States and they met a Christian, or they were at a youth hostel in Vietnam and they were like, man, I had these long talks with this guy about the same kind of thing we're talking about. I'm like, ding, ding, they met a Christian. So what I told you about the fact that they don't know a true believer, the travel bug that Europeans have, that has brought them in contact with some believers, thankfully. So that's one trend that I've seen. If there's been some background that could have happened, we have a high anxiety level that was already like being written up about university students in Amsterdam pre-COVID. So, you know, as far as people taking medication for that kind of thing, I don't know what it's like in the States, but, or just in general, not just students, just high numbers of people that are on meds every day for anxiety, depression kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I think that at least makes people know, you know, the pride factor goes down with, I can manage life. Oops, I can't manage life. So that at least it might not make them necessarily open to Christianity, but they're open that knowing I need something. I need something.
That's good.
So I have two questions and then I'll let's wrap it up, Brad. How do you find low-hanging fruit if you're a student?
Well, as one of my, someone I look up to who came out of a ministry in Nebraska, Carl, he's been in Scotland and now they're in Dublin. He said, you better pray like crazy. When he knew I was moving to Germany, it was kind of like, from a missionary standpoint, good luck. He said, you're going to have to pray like crazy. So I specifically pray. I say, God, give me three guys and three girls, you know, give me that are hungry. So I pray for hunger. I make list of names. And then like, once I know you, you get on that list that I'm praying for you by name, just praying for the soil ahead of time, getting prayer partners and communicating well. So asking people, would you pray every day when I'm on a summer trip? So not underestimating the fact that you've got to have a prayer covering for your own protection. I mean, I'm in Europe, it's still, I need my thought life, my depression. I don't have depression, but I mean, I need my negativity, my complaining spirit, that I need God's protection over my flesh, right? Mm-hmm. The team needs protection and interaction. So if the enemy can use fatigue, a broken bike, whatever, you know, and you'll go, oh, no, that wasn't like spiritual warfare. We're not in a Muslim country. I'm like, it's a different kind of spiritual warfare. It's the gray days. It's the, oh, I forgot my jacket. It's really cold. Oh, yeah, it does get really cold in the summers in Europe, you know. So just the fatigue. I've had people come there just like, I'm tired all the time. And I'm like, it's partly jet lag. And then it's partly you're like trying to think and manage the, you know, the streetcars and the trams and, you know, try to remember things. But part of it, it's spiritual warfare. And it's like, there's like in the air, I can't explain it. It's just like, you just, there's like a heaviness, you know, it's that because I can tell you places to go where you don't feel it. I can tell you, if you go to the YWAM building, Youth with a Mission building, you walk in their building because they have Bible school there all the time, prayer meetings all the time. They have a prayer tower. It's like filled with Christians. And you walk in, you go, oh, what's that? What is I walked in there? It's like, what is this? There's something. And I don't get vibes about buildings. You know, I'm not like, oh, the building has. I was like, there's something. There's something about. I go, oh, it's peace.
Yeah.
I feel a peace. So then when you experience that, you realize that's what I'm not feeling the rest of the city.
Yeah. So instead of a daily shot of coffee, you need a daily walk by the YWAM building, come inside, get a little prayer covering.
Prayer covering.
Last question, Martha.
But I would say expect that God is going to move. I had an intern in Spain and they were there for like 3 months overlapping with me. And at the end, we had the evaluation and we ate at a fun, you know, American style restaurant. And I'm like, okay, so tell me what we've learned. Let's evaluate. Let's debrief, you know, let's lean into what God's done. And she said, you know, really, we actually kind of started to see a group come together. And I go, yeah, we did. She goes, but it seemed like you always believed that that would happen. But I didn't really think, I wasn't sure it was going to happen. I'm like, what? Well, I mean, I just thought, you know, we're going to try things, but I don't know if it'll really work. And I go, well, of course it's, something's going to work. She goes, how did you know that? Because God called me here. People, you know, people that were anointed asked me to come. You know, there was Bestätigung, that's German word for confirmation from different people. So I knew when I land in Seville, God's going to do something. I don't know what he's going to do. The first year, there were four guys that gave their life to Christ, like God, like males, college students. that doesn't sound like a lot to you. But for me, I was like, oh, is this not normal? Everyone's like, this doesn't happen. I'm like, well, I don't know. I don't know what we're doing, but you know, four guys are giving their life to Christ. So I'm expecting God to work. If God sends you someplace, that his invitation is there. He's got somebody for you to make a difference in.
Last question. What will it take for Germany and Holland to be reached again?
Doing the easy ones at the end here, James, right?
Yeah. Okay. I'm hesitate. I know the answer. I hesitate because I don't like it. I think it's the same thing for the U.S. I think lots of problems. If the rug gets pulled out from under people, unfortunately, there's an illustration that I learned at Hope, RIPE, how you know that people are more ripe for the gospel, more relationships are. I, they show spiritual interest. E is encounters. They keep having encounters with God. And that could be in dreams too. The E encounters, you run into them for some reason. P is problems. So I don't wish problems on people, but I think that's the only thing, the rug getting pulled out of people's pride where they feel desperate. But I don't want to live in a country where there's a lot of problems. But I'm afraid that's the answer actually for revival.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, we so appreciate you being on the podcast. I know we send teams to you, but if people wanted to connect more to you, how could they do that? Or if a church wanted to become involved with your ministry?
Absolutely. Yeah, I can send you about, we call it our Boundless Initiative, how we have interns come long-term for a year or longer. And we also work through Reliant Mission, which is a marvelous organization that I'm actually working with out of Orlando. They could contact me at gomartha1@gmail.com. Gomartha1. I didn't make that up. A friend of mine said, go Martha. And so I said, okay, that's a good little email. Yeah. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
You're welcome. We'll put it in the show notes and we hope and pray that it's good and useful as our teams and alumni listen to this. We pray that the unreached will be reached and we're so grateful for your work over there.
Yeah, thanks. Always wonderful to chat with you, Martha, and it's challenging and encouraging at the same time. So grateful for your ministry.
Thank you. Thank you, Brad and James.
All right. Well, we'll see you next time on the One Link Podcast.